ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिः श्रुणुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवांसस्तनूभिः व्यसेमदेवहिदं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्ताक्षरिष्टनेमि स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Let the Almighty Lord, Indra, Garuda, the Sun, and all other different aspects of the Absolute Reality grant us peace, harmony, and long life. Om peace, peace, peace. So, I was discussing the first verse of the fourth section, the fourth chapter, or fourth prakarana of Gaudapada's Kariga, which is a commentary in metrical form running into 215 verses on the Upanishad, Mandukya Upanishads. So last time we already discussed certain aspects of the philosophical landscape in which this work emerged. It came to be written in the 6th century AD. As I said, there were different schools of Buddhist philosophy prevalent at that time. And Gaudapada wrote this work incorporating some of the ideas from Buddhist philosophy, especially the two schools of Buddhist idealism, the Yogacara or Vijnanavada and Shunyavada, which is the doctrine of emptiness. Yogacara philosophy is sometimes dismissed as some kind of puerile subjective idealism, which is a view not accepted by modern Buddhist scholars. Shall give a philosophical background. Now, to begin with, Mandukya Upanishad and Mandukya Kariga approaches the Absolute Reality from a particular angle, from the angle of our common sense experience of daily life. Human experience can be divided into three levels: the experiences during waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. Gaudapada points out that both the waking and dream states have many similarities. In waking and dream states, there is objectivity. I mean, there is the appearance of external objects. There are some differences, but still there is one similarity, and the similarity is the appearance of external objects in both the waking and dream states. In waking stage, these objects are visible. We can interact with these objects, not only with mind, but also with our five senses of perception, like the eyes, the ears, the sense of touch, sense of smell, and also with the five senses of action, like hands, feet, and so on. Now, Gaudapada says, in dream states, also, we interact with external objects. The external objects do exist. But the way we interact with them is somewhat different. In dream state, mind alone projects objectivity. Objectivity doesn't depend upon the appearance or existence of external objects in dream state. Rather, objectivity depends upon the mental projection from memories and impressions. This was already pointed out when we discussed the early chapters, but all these points should be kept in mind for a thorough understanding of the fourth chapter, which is supposed to be one of the most celebrated philosophical treatises. Especially when you read these verses along with the great commentary of Shankaracharya. It was Shankaracharya's commentary that made this fourth chapter such a celebrated philosophical treatise, which was a subject of discussion among many Indologists, among many scholars, especially during the first half of 20th century. Just right from the days of Schopenhauer, who first happened to read the Latin translation of 50 Upanishads, which is complete in 1801, from that time onwards, till about, say, the later half of, till the beginning of 60s, in the last century, these subjects were discussed, debated, and written about by Western and Eastern scholars. So Gaudapada says that human life is to be taken in its totality. Many people, you know, from a common sense point of view, may argue, well, dream objects are unreal, waking objects are real. When we walk in waking state, it is a real experience, but in dream, well, it is not a real experience. The argument to counter this point of view is this, that for the dreamer, dream objects are as real for the person who is experiencing different things, going through different experiences in waking state. For the dreamer, dream experiences are only reality. Just as for all of us, during waking state, waking experiences are only reality. So suppose a person lives for 90 years, and if he sleeps for 8 hours a day, we can say for about 30 years he's sleeping, we don't see that he lived only for 60 years. 30 years also counted. Now, Gaudapada's point of view is that in dream state, we are experiencing everything in a subtle manner without the association or the help of the external objects or the five senses of perception or the five senses of action. In dream state, everything takes place at the mental level. And another point that Gaudapada points out, that is a deeper psychological implication. See, what we experience is not only what we experience with our hands or feet or the eyes during waking state. When we remember something, it is also as much as an experience as real action. Memory is as subtle, as powerful as an experience, as real action. A flashing thought in our mind also registers its impression in the mind. And these impressions remain potent, and they may come to the surface, not only, maybe not now, but maybe after several years. If you believe in the theory of rebirth, then maybe after several births. That's why we sometimes exhibit certain special characteristics which we have no way of fully understanding or comprehending in the light of our experiences in this life. It's possible. So many of these mysteries are explained in the light of law of karma and rebirth. Of course, based on the belief that every action verbal, mental, intellectual, and also physical, will leave an impression in the mind. And that impression continues to outlive the body and will form a strong background which constitutes our character, which again determines our actions. Now, in this chapter, Gaudapada uses a very interesting simile, which is called the fire circle simile. His theory is this. It is called the ontophenomenology of Gaudapada's theory. Means, what is the ontological status of the phenomenal experiences? That's the idea behind. The phenomenal experiences are constituted by names and forms. Whatever we experience in association with names and forms. Gaudapada's theory is that this world has no real existence. This world, in the absolute sense, is non-existent. Only consciousness or Atman exists. Then why do we experience this manifoldness of phenomenal world? So he gives a simile. Suppose you hold in your hand a lighted torch and you rotate. And now, depending upon how you rotate, you will be forming different circles with the fire. Now, these circles or different forms are really a matter of illusion, imagination. They do not originate from the lighted torch. And when you stop rotating the torch, these forms do not dissolve into the lighted torch. First of all, they never came into existence, therefore they never returned. Similarly, all these manifold experiences that we interact, that we encounter in this world, are impressions. When impressions are associated with consciousness, we experience this manifoldness. Therefore, Gaudapada says there is only one way to get out of this manifold experiences, which consist of pain and pleasure, joy and sorrow, satisfaction and disappointment, good and bad. That's how the world is presenting itself before us, in the form of name and form. Sometimes we are happy, sometimes we are unhappy. When we are happy, we think world is fine. But that kind of happiness is only short-lived. The very idea that the world is fine, that life is a very happy process, creates terrible disappointment and dissatisfaction and grief when the slightest pain is experienced. You will never feel pain unless you are fully convinced that the world ought to have no painful experience. When we think that the world is always in its natural condition, always a matter of pleasure and happiness, then naturally we feel terrible dissatisfaction when we have to encounter a painful experience. Therefore, Gaudapada puts forward one very interesting doctrine here. It is technically, you find in science called Asparsa Yoga, means. Sparsha means contact. See, how do we experience pain and pleasure? Because we associate Atman with this manifold experiences of names and forms, pain and pleasure. On the one hand, there is the absolute reality, the Atman, we are the Supreme Consciousness, the all-pervading reality, which is beyond both pain and also pleasure. And therefore, it never suffers grief because it never enjoys. Anything or anybody who experiences enjoyment and happiness will have to experience pain and grief. So this Atman is beyond both pain and also pleasure. Therefore, complete dissociation of our true self with the senses and sensory world is the only path to real absolute happiness. Real absolute happiness is different from empirical happiness. Happiness associated with some empirical material satisfaction is momentary. But happiness which goes beyond this momentary satisfaction, happiness, a sense of happiness which helps us, well, there is nothing more to be gained. That experience comes when mind is totally disconnected with the world of senses. So long as mind is connected to the world of senses, there will be pleasure, and invariably there will be pain also. But the moment we dissociate mind with the world of senses, then mind is no more mind. Mind is Atman. Mind itself is called mind in the ordinary sense when it is in a state of flux, constantly changing. When that mind disconnects itself from the world of senses, of pain and pleasure, then it is in a state of perfect tranquility, peace, and real absolute happiness. This is what Gaudapada calls Asparsa Yoga, a very important contribution of Gaudapada to Advaita philosophy. The idea doesn't originate from Gaudapada, but the idea was given a new turn and a great philosophical emphasis by Gaudapada. Now, this idea was later incorporated by Buddhist philosophers, especially in the Yogacara and Shunyavada systems of Buddhist philosophy, which are the two schools of Buddhist idealism. Yogacara, sometimes called Vijnanavada, and also Shunyavada, in English we call it the doctrine of emptiness. So the idea that you live in this world, but don't be a participant in this drama of worldly life. And then you can be free from all the problems associated with this worldly life. This idea originally comes from Gaudapada's concept of Asparsa Yoga. How do we disconnect our mind from the external world of senses? We can't do it physically. See, suppose you make a decision tomorrow onwards, I won't allow my mind to be distracted in one direction by one particular object. If you take a decision, that decision is taken at the mental level. And therefore what happens, we always try to disconnect the mind from that particular object. And every moment you try to do that, you are actually connecting your mind to that object. That's what really happens. Real disconnection takes place when the mind never thinks of those objects. If the mind constantly struggles to disconnect itself from that object, psychologically, the mind is always intensely connected to that subject. Therefore, how do we disconnect the mind from these things? By understanding the truth that these worldly experiences, these manifold worldly experiences, are all momentary experiences. They are not real. We take something seriously only when we think it is real. Otherwise, we won't take it seriously. Whenever we take something very seriously, there is always behind that, there is a psychological idea that it is something very important, very relevant, very crucial, and very real. But the moment we live in this world and we believe that, well, this world is something in which we have to live, we have to interact with this world. But the world as such is always a momentary phenomenon. It is in a constant flux. It is just a vibration of the mind. In reality, it is Atman everywhere. And Atman is unchanging, changeless, immortal, eternal reality. Everything else comes and goes. They are not totally non-existent. They are only relative. There you find a distinction is to be drawn between Yogacara philosophy of Buddhism and Vedanta. Yogacara philosophy of Buddhism is technically called idealistic metaphysics. Vedanta is realistic metaphysics. Vedanta doesn't say that external things are totally unreal, non-existent. Vedanta says they are not real in the absolute sense, but they are not unreal in the absolute sense. If they were totally unreal, we would never feel it. We would never think of it. We never think of anything which is totally unreal, which cannot be even intellectually conceived of. But obviously, we know very well that whatever we find in this world is momentary. So they are only relative. So Vedanta says these external things are not absolute realities. They are only relative. So real philosophy of Shankaracharya is realistic metaphysics. But Buddhist Yogacara philosophy or subjective idealism is called idealistic metaphysics. We totally reject even the relative existence of external things. While admitting that external objects are momentary, the subjective idealists of Buddhist tradition argue because they are momentary, they are totally unreal. That creates a problem for us. If we are told that these external things are totally unreal, they are all imaginations, then how do we explain the experiences that we undergo in our everyday life? So Vedanta steps in and gives a realistic turn to philosophy and says that these external things are relative. They are not absolutely real. That gives a logical explanation to the experience in this world, to the reality of external experiences in this world. At the same time, it also points to a higher reality which is behind all this. For that, Vedanta brings in the doctrine of Maya. Maya or ignorance. This is a very scientific and psychologically very rational explanation of why we live in this world, why we experience what we are experiencing. It's a very, very logical explanation. I have attempted this a few times, but it's very important, especially when we begin the fourth chapter. Maya doctrine says this much. The external things are not absolutely unreal, because if they were unreal, we won't experience it. Nor absolutely real, because if they were absolutely real, they are eternal. In that case, we can't say consciousness or Atman is the only reality. So these external experiences are given the ontological status of relativity. This is at the ontological level. At the psychological level, Vedanta gives a very interesting explanation. We always feel a kind of uncertainty, unpredictability in our life. See, we know very well how a machine works because we have programmed an artificial intelligence to the machine. So we can be very sure how that machine is going to work. But we can never be sure as to how our mind is going to function. It is impossible. Because we can control everything in this world except our own mind. There are millions of people in this world who would like to be saints and sages and philosophers. But not all of them succeed. There are many people in the world who want to do great and good things, but they do not always succeed. Really, they want and they try, but at the last moment, they find that their mind is not willing, the mind is not allowing them what they would like to do. So what is the reason for it? On the one hand, we can say our inherited characteristics and the pull of our previous karmas or actions may be behind. So this uncertainty can only be explained in terms of Maya. Means a mental condition which is real in an empirical sense but unreal in the absolute sense. Swami Vivekananda trying to explain how Maya works in our ordinary life gives an explanation. You know. A mother brings up a child with all love and affection. It could be the other way also. Maybe father could maybe. And that child becomes a rogue and still the mother cannot detach her mind from the child. There are many things that we won't like to do, that we would like to avoid doing, but we do. And there are many things, many great things that we would like to do, but we cannot. So this uncertainty is sometimes explained as a manifestation of Maya at the psychological or individual level. At the cosmic level, it is the explanation of the relative world. At the psychological level, it is the explanation of a psychological pull that is beyond explanation. But the moment we understand it is Maya, we are out of it. But this is possible. This understanding is possible only when we realize what is behind and above all this. That is the Atman. The moment we realize that we are the Atman, we are not just the psychophysical mechanisms, we are something beyond all this, we are the all-pervading reality, we are not these physical bodies which come and go, we are not even the minds which enjoy and suffer, we are not just a set of senses, mind and intellect, a complex mechanism which functions in the world, suffering and enjoying, tossed about by the fate or by our own instincts and characters. But we are in reality the supreme consciousness, the Atman, the all-pervading reality, who is essentially the blissful reality. The moment we realize this, we are out of this Maya. So Gaudapada's first verse in the fourth chapter begins as a prayer, as an invocation, as paying homage to great spiritual personalities who have realized this truth. I have already explained this, but I shall just refer to this. ജ്ഞാനേന ആകാശകൽപ്പേന ധർമാൻ യോ ഗഗനോപമാൻ ജ്ഞേയ അഭിന്നേന സംബുദ്ധസ്തം വന്ദേ ദ്വിപദാം വരം. ഗോഡബാദ യൂസസ് ദ ടേം ബുദ്ധ. സോ ബുദ്ധ ഇൻ സാൻസ്ക്രിറ്റ് മീൻസ് ദ എൻലൈറ്റൻഡ് വൺ. ഗൗതമ ബുദ്ധ ഓൾസോ ക്യാൻ ബി ടേക്കൺ ആസ് എൻ എക്സാമ്പിൾ. സോ ഐ ഓൾറെഡി എക്സ്പ്ലെയിൻ, സോ ഐ വോണ്ട് റിപ്പീറ്റ് അഗെയിൻ. That supreme spiritual person who has realized his true nature as Atma, I bow down before him, because the one who realizes this supreme reality also realizes that he is the all-pervading Brahman or Atman, which is in the form of absolute knowledge, absolute existence, and absolute bliss. This is the first verse I already explained. Now, in the second verse, Gaudapada explains what I said earlier. Asparsayogo vainama sarvasattu sukho hitaha avivadu aviruddhascha deshidamstam namamekam. So, I shall just read out the, just try to explain the prose order. Sarva sattva sukhaha hitaha avivadaha aviruddhaha asparsayogaha vainama deshitaha tam aham namami. Again, the idea is repeated. I bow down before the great spiritual person, the one who has realized this supreme truth, and also this supreme ideal, which is called Asparsha Yoga. As I said, Asparsha Yoga technically means that state of human mind where we have realized that we are something beyond the world of senses. The mind is completely disconnected from the world of senses. Any association with any of the five senses of perception or five senses of action brings pain and grief. As I said earlier, even as the so-called pleasurable experience can be a source of pain, because when it is lost, it takes us back to the previous state. When we have not gained that pleasurable experience, we are experiencing pain. When we have got it, we are anxious not to lose it. And we know very well that whatever we get, whatever material enjoyment that one can think of in this world is momentary, it will be lost. And that loss will create grief and sorrow. That's why Gaudapada says, this Asparsha Yoga, this attitude, this spiritual state of human mind, when mind is completely free from any association with the senses or sensory objects, it is Sarva Sattva Sukha, means it is the source of supreme joy and happiness and tranquility for all beings. In a way, from a psychological angle, we are all searching for some kind of dissociation from the world of senses. People go to a movie theater to forget a nagging pain within. They take to drinks to forget something which is a source of grief and sorrow within. They are going after something which brings greater sorrow and greater grief. That's a different matter. But for the moment, people believe that if they can benumb the senses, if they can run away from themselves, they are trying to escape from themselves. is a kind of flight from themselves, running away from one's own mind, psychologically speaking. So every human effort is in reality an effort to gain freedom from the world of senses. But in all cases, what happens? It brings greater bondage. As I said earlier, people take to drugs and drinks to forget something, to get freedom from some nagging, tormenting memory or experience that may be tormenting their mind. For that, so they want to forget it. And when you try to forget something, you try to run away from it. An effort to forget something is nothing but an effort to run away from it. So, everybody is going in search of freedom, joy, peace, and tranquility. But they are all knocking at the wrong doors. The way they go in search of this freedom only brings them to greater and greater bondage, brings them greater and greater pain and grief. So Gaudapada says, the way to real freedom, the way to real spiritual liberation is not to go after the world of senses, but to go away from the world of senses. As I said earlier, this is not possible by psychologically taking a decision not to do something. It's a mental decision, because mind will always try to disconnect from something, and that effort to disconnect connects it to that object. Sometimes I said earlier, you know, there is an interesting story. A person who was slowly becoming bald-headed, losing all hair, went to a doctor, and the doctor gave one interesting prescription. You have seen egg, you're eating plenty of eggs, and you're always thinking about eggs. Now, you know, egg is like a baldy's head. So you should stop thinking about egg. Then, this problem, the hair loss, this is only antidote, only medicine. Stop thinking about eggs. So this man always worried that whether I should ever think about egg, so I should always avoid thinking about eggs. So his constant effort to avoid thinking about eggs made him think about eggs only. So he went completely bad in one time. Now, Gaudapada says, if you want to mentally and psychologically disconnect yourself from something, you should not psychologically try to disconnect your mind from it. Your approach towards the world of senses should change. We can ignore something when we understand that it is not of much value. It really has no reality. So the moment we realize that this manifoldness, this empirical world of senses, really is not of much importance, you need not run away from it. One should do our duties and responsibilities. But behind all this effort to do our duties and responsibilities, to live the life of an ideal member of society, an ideal citizen of the country, with a successful businessman or an efficient administrator or professor, whoever may be. Behind all this, if we can remember, well, it's all necessary, but all these things are momentary. Momentary in the sense, you know, even if it lasts for several years, it is momentary. In Buddhist philosophy, it is called Kshanabhangavada or Kshanikavada. That is a basis, that is one of the pillars of Buddhist philosophical tradition. in a broader sense, we can say anything which is not eternal is momentary. Moment need not mean just 1 minute or 1 second. According to Vedanta, Atman is the only reality. Even the world, which may be 13.8 billion years old, can be considered to be, the universe can be considered to be momentary. In the sense, it's not eternal. It originated sometime in the past, and it will cease to exist sometime in future. It will change its form and shape. So behind all this, there is one absolute reality, which is Atman. So even while being engaged in our daily duties and responsibilities, if we can keep somewhere in a corner of our mind the idea that these things are not eternal, these things come and go. Even while enjoying a promotion in your profession, even when celebrating a success in business, we can keep somewhere in a corner of our mind that, well, it will come, it will go. It is not eternal. This attitude will save us from a lot of grief, pains and sorrows and undesirable experiences. Now here, we are not psychologically trying to disconnect our mind from these things. We change our attitude towards these things. We realize the fact that these things are not eternal. The moment we realize that these things are not eternal, then mind slowly gets disconnected. It doesn't mean that we should be negligent or no, never. But too much of obsession with worldly enjoyments and pleasures, which always brings grief and sorrow later on, can be avoided by disconnecting the mind from the world of senses. That's why Vedanta philosophy says that if we succumb to the tyranny of the senses, it is spiritual slavery, spiritual death. But if we get freedom from the tyranny of senses, it is spiritual liberation. That's the idea behind. So that's why Gaudapada says, this Asparsha Yoga, this attitude of dissociating or disconnecting the mind from senses, from the experience of pleasure and pain, is the one way for real peace and tranquility of mind. That's what Gaudapada says. Every other effort gives a momentary distraction, but it will only bring in greater grief and greater sorrow. So he says, therefore he says, the Sanskrit word is used, sarva sattva sukha, means it is the source of joy and peace and tranquility for all people. Disconnecting the mind from the world of senses, keeping the mind in a state where it is convinced that it is the all-pervading Atman, Supreme Consciousness. And then the mind is no more a mind. You know, normally what we call mind in Vedanta is nothing but the vibration of impressions and tendencies. Fluctuating vibrations of impressions and tendencies. That's what we call stream consciousness, William James called. That's what we call mind. So, but this fluctuation, this stream consciousness, exists only if the mind is connected to the worldly objects through senses. The moment this connection is gone, then mind is no more mind. Mind is in a state of perfect tranquility and peace. Then you realize you are the Atman. One may ask the question, why is this possible? Constant reading of these verses, or reminding ourselves of this truth, is one way. Even intellectual conviction serves a great purpose. At least in times of crisis, one can just think, well, All these momentary pleasures and pains will come and go. There is something beyond all this, compared to which all these things are just fleeting pictures. The moment we realize that, we will reach a state of perfect tranquility and peace. This is Gaudapada's view. Those who are interested in Buddhist philosophy should remember, you know, in Buddhist philosophical tradition, whenever Buddhist philosophers use the word Atman, Buddhi, etc., they are really talking about the internal organs, Chittam, Jivatma, and so on. Of course, those ideas are not relevant in this particular context. I will try to explain this earlier. Then another adjective which the author uses is avivada, means there is no doubt, there is no difference of views with regard to the fact that the moment we go beyond the ideas of pain and pleasure, we experience that eternal, everlasting tranquility and peace. That's the idea. Now we'll go to the next verse. If you have any points that you would like to raise, we'll discuss. We have about 10 minutes, 5 minutes we have. Anything that you want me to clarify further, I can ask. Yes. Now, this idea as an experience, as a supreme experience, comes only when we spiritually evolve. That is true. But the logic of this idea can be appreciated even by people who are seekers. There are seekers belong to different levels, different categories. There are people who suffer and sometimes they feel the pain, the sorrows of material life so much that they turn towards something higher. Such people, though they may not get the blissful experience of this at that level, when they read it, suddenly they will understand the psychological logic of it. Because there are many people who suffer a lot and who understand it is their obsession with the material things that brings all these undesirable experiences. Such people sometimes take a new turn as a way out of these problems. So they get the intellectual conviction. So once you get an intellectual conviction, that intellectual conviction can be brought down to the mental level. As I said, you know, there is always a gap between the intellectual and the mental. An intellectual conviction may not always be helpful in times of crisis, Because we, all of us, live at the mental level, at the emotional level. 99% of our life is at the mental level, not intellectual level. So this intellectual conviction can be brought down to the mental level by constant thinking. And also by trying to logically analyze our experiences with the logic of this doctrine. See, if we know that it is our obsession with the material enjoyments, material achievements, desire for material achievements, that's at the root of all these, painful experiences, then one will naturally be eager to get out of this. So intellectual conviction sometimes can come down to the mental level if we constantly think. We have to establish a link between this intellectual conviction and our everyday life situations. A real conviction is always, a sincere conviction is always helpful. Sincere conviction. It depends upon the intensity with which this conviction comes, you know, emerges in our mind. That is true. As it is not just a philosophical doctrine, in a way it is psychologically a very rational doctrine. Psychologically. See, every human being is one way or other trying to get peace of mind. What we normally call enjoyment or happiness is nothing but peace of mind. Mind wants to be free from undesirable tendencies, impressions, experiences, thought currents. That's what we want. That's what everybody is seeking. For that, people are knocking at different doors, taking to different channels, very often undesirable channels. So here is a path. Well, and second point is, psychologically speaking, when people do something undesirable, there is always the feeling, or when they have gained a painful experience, sometimes they have the feeling that painful experience is permanent, a permanent state. That wrong idea is associated with the experience of pain. It's not so. It's real. It will be permanent. That idea comes. A child becomes very happy if you give him a chocolate. But he thinks the chocolate gives him a pleasurable experience which is everlasting. For a moment, it thinks so. So it becomes very happy. But the moment if a child is told it won't give you permanent enjoyment, or he won't go for it. But a child cannot be convinced. Human beings are also sometimes like children. Grown-up human beings are also like children. From a Vedantic perspective, we call it Balaha. So if we can reach a sincere intellectual conviction that the world of senses can only bring us momentary experiences, whether pain or pleasure, then they will not be such a source of distraction. We will not be obsessed with it. We need not run away from it, but obsession can be avoided. People go out of their way to make money, thinking that money will bring everything. They may have read Kant and Hegel and Spinoza and Shankaracharya. They may have read it. They may be well learned people. But the moment they do something, at that moment they believe, well, that will bring us a permanent peace. So at that moment, if this conviction, intellectual conviction, helps them, that comes as a great help. So intellectual conviction has got a great moral value. Constantly, if you read and if you think, then slowly it comes down to the mental level from the intellectual. The moment it becomes a mental conviction, then it becomes an attitude, and that becomes a great help, source of help. It should become an attitude. From an intellectual conviction, it should become an attitude in our life. It should influence our attitude. That's why one great One great admirer of Vedanta philosophy, Will Dewson, says the idea of relativity of external experiences has got a great moral message behind it, great ethical message. Because behind every unethical activities, there is maybe a hidden conviction that these activities will give you eternal peace or whatever, money or wealth or whatever may be. The moment we change our attitude and start looking upon these external things as something which comes and goes, not permanent but momentary, then we won't go after that. These external objects will not be able to dictate to our mind as to what we should do and what should not do. Then becomes a great moral imperative and moral force. That is the ethical dimension of Vedanta philosophy. The momentariness of external world, the non-eternal nature of the empirical experiences, empirical world, is not only a metaphysical doctrine and a fact, but also a great moral imperative, because behind every unethical activity, there is the conviction that this unethical activity, which brings you some enjoyment in material world, will give you permanent peace and happiness. So that wrong notion is removed by the intellectual conviction. Well, this world is all right, but it is certainly not going to be there for all times. That idea. The relativity of external world, empirical world, is a great moral force. That's the idea behind. So we'll continue.
Isn't there a lot of people, though, that think that maybe everything is just temporary, and as a result, they're like, well, I might as well take the pleasure now, because it's temporary anyways. So having this intellectual conviction that there's something beyond temporary, isn't that a matter of faith? And some people have it, and some people don't have it?
Well, it depends upon our own spiritual evolution. Vedanta believes, Vedanta says, we have inherited characteristics, tendencies, impressions, not only from this life, from previous life. Whatever we have done in the past, previous life, all these leave behind an impression or a tendency which constitutes our character. And some of these characteristics drive us in one direction. That's why sometimes, in spite of our greatest intense desire to do something noble, at the time of doing, we are not able to do that. Sometimes people are tempted, but when they do it, they do it only noble things. They do only noble and great and good things. So it works both ways. So what we can do, which means, our mind is a bag of tendencies and impressions, both negative and positive. In fact, many psychiatrists try to explain schizophrenia and multiple personality problems in the light of manifold karmas and tendencies and impressions. That's one theory being put forward by professional psychiatrists. But leave that subject behind. Now, the idea is this. If our mind is full of positive and negative tendencies and impressions, how can we reduce the impact of the negative tendencies and increase the influence of positive tendencies? By doing deliberate good actions. Actions need not necessarily mean physical actions. Even if you hear a good word, and if that registers an impression in your mind, even if you think or listen to these ideas, they all will create a positive tendency or impression in the mind. So that will reinforce the storehouse of positive spiritual tendencies. That will help us to go forward. Yes, that experience comes when we go ahead. Slowly that experience will come. Because as our mind starts being influenced by positive impressions and tendencies, slowly our mind moves away from the negative. Because negative tendencies become increasingly weaker and weaker, and positive tendencies become stronger. So then mind slowly evolves. That's how mind evolves. And as it evolves, at one point, you get a flash of some experience. And that helps us to move further forward. That's why even reading a good book, a book which helps us spiritually, by listening to something that is helpful in spiritual life, by thinking something, doing whatever, all these will create a positive impression. It's like money that you deposit in bank, because that will store up these positive tendencies and impressions, which always come to a rescue in times of crisis. Exactly. The mind slowly evolves without our being aware of it often. Right. So thank you. We'll continue the discussion the next class. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om. Sri Ramakrishna. Namaste.